Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the Arab Spring and its aftermath in Egypt and Libya with Sama Shahata, Professor of Arab Politics at Georgetown University, who has recently returned from Egypt. Then we'll look into the extraordinary overreaction to the boneheaded provocations of an obscure media-hungry Florida pastor's burning of the Quran. A former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a friend of one of the women butchered by the rampaging mob, Christine Fair, joins us. She is a professor in peace and security studies at Georgetown University. Then finally, we'll talk with the real Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Robert and Dana Baer, authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story. George Clooney won an Academy Award for portraying Robert Baer in the movie Syriana, which was based on Baer's book, See No Evil. Robert Baer met his wife, Dana, who was a CIA shooter assigned to protect him in Sarajevo during the Bosnian War. Let's now start with a discussion on Egypt and Libya. Joining us now is Sama Shahata, who is a professor at the Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sama Shahata.
Thank you.
And clearly, there has been lots of reports from the PBS Frontline series. The New York Times did a series of articles as well on the notion that this youth-driven, largely middle-class rebellion in Egypt that we all witnessed is slowly being captured by the Muslim Brotherhood, who have made some unholy alliance with the Egyptian military, who are very much in control of the country. What, since you've just returned from Egypt recently, what's your sense of that analysis?
Well, I think that analysis is exaggerated to a significant extent. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist forces have awoken in Egypt in a new environment. I mean, in the past, of course, under the Mubarak regime, they faced significant repression that could mean arbitrary detention, arrests, prison time, and, of course, harassment at the time of election, including fraudulent election results. This is, of course, a new period for groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who are the most organized and possibly the largest opposition group. So clearly, they are ecstatic at the new found freedoms that they have, and there is some fear, of course, among secular parties and individuals and others that they will become increasingly powerful. But I think it would be mistaken to say that they have entered some kind of an alliance with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or that some kind of a deal has been made and that they're poised to take over the country. There's very little evidence of that, in fact. I can understand the fears that people might have, some of the fears, as it were, but I'm actually much more optimistic. And I think that in addition to the newfound freedoms that groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are enjoying, I think other groups certainly are going to emerge that are going to represent different political ideas. And moreover, we've already seen some fragmentation within the Muslim Brotherhood. We've seen the emergence of other groups on the left and on the right that is more progressive and more conservative than the Muslim Brotherhood, who are going to compete among each other for votes and so on. So I think it would be overstating the fact to say that the Muslim Brotherhood now is poised to take over the revolution, or that they have made some kind of an alliance with the Supreme Military Council and things are moving in a particular direction.
But the Supreme Military Council, who are very much in control, there was some indications in the referendum, that the recent referendum that got, 77% of the vote, that many of the leaders of the revolution in Tahrir Square were opposed to it, and for the reasons that we've just discussed, the notion that they may be aced out of power. What's your analysis of that?
Well, you know, I was there at the time of the significant discussion and heated debate before the referendum, and certainly you're correct that most progressive intellectuals, those who are active in politics, who are secular. In fact, I think it also coincided with whether one was kind of urban, upper middle class, and so on, voted against the constitutional amendments, and for some good reasons. At the same time, however, I think it would also be mistaken to attribute the 77.2% of the voters who voted yes for the constitutional amendments to attribute that high percentage to Muslim Brotherhood support. Certainly the Muslim Brotherhood supported the amendments, and there was also, unfortunately, some misinformation and use of religion to entice people, not necessarily by the Muslim Brotherhood, but by others, to vote yes for the constitutional amendments. But I think that the vast majority of Egyptians felt, and I disagree with this, I would have voted if I was in the country against the constitutional amendments, but I don't think it's that important. The most of the people voted yes for the constitutional amendments because they felt they were sufficient to move forward at this particular time to move to an elected parliament and an elected president. And there's no indication that that's not going to move forward as scheduled. In fact, one of the fears that people who voted against the constitutional amendments, that is holding elections too early in June, as was previously announced for parliament, and August for president, that has been delayed. So at least partially that concern has been addressed. And now we are told by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that parliamentary elections are going to be held in September and presidential elections are going to be held somewhat after that, giving new groups, giving opposition parties, secular parties, and so on, a little bit more time to organize.
Again, I'm speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University, and we're talking about the day-after scenarios of the Arab Spring in Egypt in particular, but we'll also move to Libya in a moment, since Libya, the composition of the opposition in Libya has always been a question, and similar objections to the Islamists in Egypt are being expressed, of course, by Gaddafi and others, including Glenn Beck. It's interesting to see Glenn Beck and Gaddafi on the same page, Samer Shahata.
Yes, I mean, if I could just say one other thing about the referendum. I think the most important thing that took place on March 19th with regards to the referendum and the 77.2% of the people who voted yes for the referendum isn't that the referendum passed or that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood supported it, but the fact that this was the first time in Egypt's modern history that there were relatively, or to a large extent, elections with integrity, where people's votes counted, that were not marred by systematic irregularities, violence, vote fraud, ballot stuffing, and so on. I mean, this Egyptian elections under the Mubarak regime were characterized by violence, regular fraud, the things that was certain about Egyptian elections, that they were not free and fair. So the fact that people stood in long lines, that there was a relatively high percentage of people who participated, that there were not significant incidences of violence, that no one died, that people actually felt their votes counted. I think that's the most important thing to take away from the March 19th referendum. With regard to the question of Islamists and Glenn Beck, you're completely correct that many people on the right in the United States are hysterical about the potential for Islamists to come to power in places like Egypt and Libya. I mean, it is the case, of course, that there is some opacity with regard to who the Libyan rebels are. There's no question that they are made up of a variety of individuals, middle-class professionals, youth, some people who clearly believe in the principles of democracy and freedom. And of course, there are also Islamists of different varieties, including some radical Islamists. There's some evidence that some people, Libyans who have returned from Iraq and elsewhere as fighters or jihadis. But I don't think it would be accurate to say that that's the majority of the opposition. I think anyone who's familiar with Libyan politics and Mr. Gaddafi's depraved autocratic regime realizes that the vast majority of Libyans are against Mr. Gaddafi, and that includes people who have no political ideas, people who are Democrats, who are liberal, who are socially conservative, and so on. And I think it's also important to understand that to a large extent, these are conservative societies. Libya may be particularly so compared with a country like Tunisia on its border, or even Egypt. And that means that there's going to be a great deal of religiosity, of belief that Islam should play some role in politics among a wide variety of people. And that in itself is not necessarily threatening to democracy or basic rights.
So, Sami Shahada, just before we move on to discuss Libya and Egypt's role or covert role of the military, Egypt's military in Libya, one bit of news, Al Jazeera is reporting that Mubarak, the former dictator, has flown out of Egypt for medical treatment in Germany. And is that likely to affect the trials? I mean, there may be some backlash from people who feel, because I understand that a lot of Mubarak's cronies are they're going to be tried. I mean, there's some serious truth and reconciliation going on.
Yes, well, let's hope that's the case. In fact, that's something that much more so than the Islamists that I have been fearful of, and that is the lack of forward progress on criminally prosecuting many people in the Mubarak regime. I mean, there were a number of individuals, including the head of the National Democratic Party, a despised figure, Safwa Tasharif, Zakaria Azmi, another presidential advisor who was working in the office of the president, and a minister, the Speaker of Parliament, Fethi Sroor, all leading cronies in the Mubarak regime who up until recently, and in fact still, are free, are allowed to do their business. One of them is still going to work. And so the fear that I have had, and I think many in Egypt have, is that the revolution isn't moving fast enough, that there are some real concerns that the Supreme Military Council are not or don't share fully the views of the millions of people who wanted regime change, who wanted a fundamentally different kind of politics, and that these people, some of them have been put on lists that do not allow them to leave the country. Others are under investigation for different kinds of fraud. A few individuals have been detained, a number of former ministers that are in jail awaiting trial, including the ex-minister of the Interior. But the concerns that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is not completely on the same page as the millions of people who wanted and not only the downfall of Mubarak, but a fundamentally different type of politics in Egypt, that's the concern that I have. With regard to Mubarak's leaving, there have been rumors, of course, in the past that Mubarak left to Saudi Arabia, that he and his family, members of his family, went to England and so on, and none of these are confirmed. Of course, it would make sense because the basic demand that is that Mubarak also be held accountable for the deaths that took place between January 25th and February 11th when he finally was removed from power. Over 300 people, civilians, were killed in those protests by the regime's security forces, by thugs, by the use of live ammunition, and so on. And of course, the illicit wealth, tremendous amounts that we've heard, varying from a few billion dollars to upwards of $40 billion stolen by the Mubarak family. So there have been calls that they need to be tried, that they need to be held accountable, and of course it would make sense that they would want to leave the country. It's known that the president's wife and at least one of his sons, Gamal Mubarak, and his family have British citizenship and that they own property there, and there were rumors that they had at least left the country earlier, but none of these are confirmed.
So, Sami Shahada, let's turn to Libya. Now, there are reports that the Libyan rebels are getting military equipment and training from the Egyptian military, perhaps some of it covert. What's your understanding of that?
Well, again, there have been some reports, in fact, from several weeks ago, earlier than more recently, than the more recent discussion of the possibility of Western countries supporting, training, providing weapons to the Libyan rebels. There were reports in the Arabic press several weeks ago that some kinds of arms shipments and so on were taking place over the Egyptian border. Now, it would make sense that, of course, the rebels would try to procure arms either with the knowledge of the Egyptian military or without the knowledge over that border. It's a somewhat porous border. It's also quite reasonable to expect that the Egyptian military doesn't want this to be, and the Egyptian government doesn't want this to be something that is known. As you know, there are hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who are still in Libya, who have been working there, who are resident there, and so on. And of course, they would be prone to attacks or reprisals by Gaddafi's forces. And it's also true that I think the United States government, as well as the government of France and Britain, would want to, and have basically stated as much, to arm the rebels. And of course, it would be easier to arm them through a third party like Egypt or Saudi Arabia than it would to do so directly for legal and for political reasons and so on. So it's not surprising to me. Also, in the last week, of course, we've learned through reporting that President Obama has signed a directive that allows CIA operatives inside Libya to gather evidence and possibly to support the rebels. And of course, there's a public discussion now in this country and in other countries about the legality of that, considering that Resolution 1970 places an arms embargo on Libya. And of course, there have been officials like Secretary Clinton and others who have argued that it would be legal to arm the rebels because 1973 UN Security Council resolution supersedes that and states that they should, that, you know, protecting civilians by all means necessary. So it wouldn't be surprising to me at all if the rebels were being armed by Western governments as well as by intermediaries such as the Egyptian armed forces, the Saudis, and others.
Well, Robert Gase, the Secretary of Defense, said in response to a question of whether the United States is arming the rebels or intends to do so, said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll let others do it. And that my impression was that perhaps that meant Egypt. And just in general, though, it would seem that given the nature of this very much ad hoc citizens' army, I mean, how often do you see people going off to war in jeans and T-shirts? And they clearly, the rebels clearly don't have the same kind of military discipline, training, and equipment that Gaddafi has. So somebody has to be organizing this mob, which has been described as a kind of Mad Max army.
Well, yes, and I think that's clearly one of the shortcomings of the rebels, the lack of training, the lack of discipline, and so on. And that, of course, accounts to some extent for their losses of territory over the last 3 days, despite the fact that in the period immediately after the commencement of bombing of Gaddafi's forces, they made tremendous progress. So, yes, I mean, that's clearly one of their deficits, one of their shortcomings, and there's talk of the necessity of actually not only supplying them weapons, but training them with regard to how to use these weapons against Gaddafi's forces. All of this, of course, means that the fighting in Libya is likely to continue for some time and not to end in the immediate days to come, unlike what many people have predicted.
Well, just in closing, though, there is a steady defection of high-level officials from Gaddafi's regime, not just the former intelligence chief, Moussa Koussa, but now his deputies just fled to Egypt, too, the deputy foreign minister. So presumably there's some useful intelligence on, mostly on Gaddafi and who's running the show, him and his sons, one of whom I believe has already been killed by an airstrike, the head of the 32nd Brigade.
Right. It's been reported that. I mean, you know, and let me be clear. The Gaddafi regime is a terrible regime, you know, that has systematically used torture, assassination, and repression against its population for the last 40 years. And in fact, I supported some kind of intervention. I hope that it would be a kind of Arab-led intervention with regards to Libya. But the situation is difficult. It's certainly messy. And the sooner that Mr. Gaddafi is removed from power, I think the better for Libya and the region. Because, of course, what is at stake is not only the future of Libya, but I think the future of Tunisia and Egypt, neighboring countries, as well as what Gaddafi remaining in power might mean for other citizens in other states, whether it be Syria or Yemen and so on, and their desires and movement for freedom in the future. So a lot is at stake here.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Samer Shahata.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a friend of one of the UN women who were butchered by the rampaging mob in response to this idiot down in Florida burning the Quran.